Since recording this episode, a terrible tragedy has occurred. The Dali cargo ship has run into and hit the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, causing 6 presumed deaths of construction workers that were working on the bridge overnight. This has caused a major impact on the community and is a terrible tragedy. This tragedy will likely feed into worse economic issues, causing higher inflation due to the impact on shipping, with an estimated impact of $15 million per day on the U.S. economy. And this doesn't even include insurance claims, which could add up to over $3 billion. Staggering numbers impacting the 8th largest port in the U.S. The Port of Baltimore handled $80 billion worth of cargo last year alone. And this underscores how the Jones Act impacts and constricts our economy by requiring only crewed and owned and built-in U.S. ships to ship between U.S. ports. Critics argue that the Jones Act limits competition and could be hindering the growth of U.S. shipping companies by increasing costs. This incident in Baltimore brings a fresh perspective on how we might balance national security with economic efficiency. As a fiscal conservative, finding economic efficiency is critical to me, and we need to look at every part of our economy and make sure we find the most efficient way to make our economy move and work for us, make sure it serves all of us, and effectively serves the U.S. and its goals. The incident serves as a catalyst for a broader conversation about how we manage and protect our infrastructure and the people who keep it running. As we move forward, it's crucial for us to reflect on how events like the Baltimore Bridge collapse affect us all, from the macro level of national policy to the individual stories of those impacted. Let's keep that dialogue open, and thanks for joining us today on Green Tea Party Radio, and we'll continue to talk more about the Jones Act coming up. Thank you for listening. Hello, and welcome to the Green Tea Party,
where we discuss conservative solutions to environmental problems. I'm Hannah Rogers.
My name is Zach Torpy. Together, we will guide you through complex issues and provide strategies to address them,
all while remaining faithful to our conservative values.
Trust me, it'll be a good time.
Yeah, it's a party, so grab your mugs and we're going to pour the tea. Alrighty, so Zach, how are you? What have you been doing? I haven't seen you in a week. What's been going on in your life? What's on your mind? Tell me everything.
Been doing a lot of research into shipping practices and found out there's been some interesting things going on around the world. Apparently, Panama has been having a drought this past couple months, and they've had to reduce how many ships they can let by. So I was in Panama last year, and you could see just miles of hundreds of ships just sort of sitting there, queuing up, waiting to go through the canal.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
And imagine just how much money they were wasting just sitting there, hanging out, doing nothing.
Yeah, I remember when I was in D.C., while I was living there, they were talking about how big of a problem is when there's like icebergs or when there's a union that's causing like the dock workers to stop working and like how much money is lost just hourly by those ships just sitting out there. So I can only imagine what this drought is doing.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, Mexico is actually proposing building a rail corridor to make like a new type of way across between the Atlantic and Pacific. So they'd have like two giant ports for ships to drop their containers off at, and then the containers could be brought through Mexico to the other side from the Atlantic to the Pacific.
Really? That's crazy. I remember when I was like in elementary school and we were learning about the building of the Panama Canal and like how huge that was for the U.S. Like, I'm curious to know, like, is a drought something that happens regularly?
Don't think it's common, but I think as climate change affects the local environment, it'll become more and more of a concern. And you need a lot of water to operate this canal and maintain the constant flow of ships.
Really? That does not surprise me at all. I think, like, you know, climate change making water more scarce, especially because the Panama Canal is, you know, it's usually pretty low to begin with, right?
I would not know, but it looked normal when I went there.
Interesting. I'm kind of curious. I want to see, like, I'm going to Google it right now. What is the average water level in the Panama Canal? Okay, let's see. Oh my gosh. It's only 80 feet? Interesting. So, you know, a drought, like it's really sensitive to droughts. Like if it's, you know, like not that, not if it's not even that intense of a drought, it could really dramatically impact the levels of the Panama Canal, right?
When I read, they had to lower the amount of ships traveling through the canal every day from 38 to 24, which may not sound like a lot, but once you're cutting shipping that much, like through like one of the most used canals in the world, it can have a big impact, especially when the alternative is going all the way around South America.
How are businesses responding to this? What are they trying to do to mitigate this?
The ones who really want to get through pay extra to go through early.
Really?
Yeah.
How? But that's not fair always, though.
Nah, life's not fair. If you got a rich business and you got to deliver products, you're gonna pay extra to get through.
Yeah, I guess that's true. So I guess it's like big businesses can afford, but small businesses can't. That's kind of something that happens in the marketplace, that it's so that the environment is selecting bigger businesses over smaller businesses. It's not always fair, but I guess that's the way life is, right?
That's why I think what Mexico is doing, building an alternate option for this that could supplement the Panama Canal, is great and will improve efficiency, hopefully lower costs overall. And we will be sticking with shipping for our topic today. We'll be talking about the Jones Act.
I don't know much about the Jones Act. Do you mind giving me like a brief overview?
Sure. The Jones Act was a law passed in 1922. It was basically to secure ship production in the U.S. to transport goods between two U.S. ports, say from like New York to Charlotte or Miami. The ship needs to be owned and operated by a U.S. crew and have a U.S. owner and be made in the U.S. I think it's something like 90% of the ship needs to be made in the U.S., needs to be 75% owned by American and 75% crewed by American. So it's got a very high level of requirements to have a ship that trades between the U.S., which is really difficult. Most countries aren't this strict with their laws. They made this rule because during World War I, Europe pulled all its ships back to Europe to start shipping goods and ammo and materials around while the war was going on. It sort of screwed the U.S. and left them hanging in the wind with nothing to move their products around the world or the U.S. So they implemented this law to sort of assuage that concern.
Interesting. So it's kind of was there to like protect U.S. manufacturers and U.S. producers and kind of keep the U.S. in control of our own shipping, right?
Yes. Yeah, it was to keep a consistent U.S. fleet available for shipping and to prevent any like sudden shocks to the system like that. It also operates as a maritime fleet to transport U.S. troops and war materials when needed, so that we could have our own transportation system for our military that's not reliant on foreign vessels.
It sounds like this policy is like really outdated. Why haven't we got rid of it yet?
So it's very heavily protected or fought for by the unions.
Mm-hmm.
These ship production are union protected jobs. Crewing ships is union protected. Everything around the shipping industry runs through unions. So the unions heavily fight against any change to this law because they don't want foreign competition in the U.S. for what they do. It's very anti-capitalistic and very protectionist and prevents like the free trade and reduces competition, which makes U.S. companies more complacent and less likely to improve and find more efficient ways to produce these ships. These laws are called cabotage laws, which are laws about trading within a country's own ports, between two ports, like carrying goods between two different ports. And we have the third most protective cabotage laws in the world after China and Indonesia. We're only one of 11 countries that fully excludes foreign vessels. This isn't a very common practice in the rest of the world.
Interesting. So what is going on the global stage that makes these countries feel like they have to be protectionist?
Well, for Indonesia, I think it's because they're an island nation. They want to make sure they maintain ships going to their islands. They don't want to run the risk of foreigners controlling what is a very necessary business in their country. But in the U.S., it seems to have raised the cost of shipping in general because it is so expensive to produce ships in the U.S. that we just don't really do it as much anymore. And other countries are far outcompeting us in production of ships. And this has led to a reduction in the shipping capacity of the U.S. and what the U.S. ships around the world.
So I'm curious, if we're not producing very many ships, how economically dangerous is that for us? Like, is it putting us in a really precarious spot?
There's two ways of looking at it. It's very good that we produce our own ships, but there are advantages to having economically competitive ships.
How does like this requirement of the Jones Act affect the U.S. maritime fleet today?
So we're producing a lot less ships. We have a lot less ships available to transport goods between our ports.
I see. If we have less ships to transport our goods, does that make us more reliant on other countries for our goods?
Yes, it makes us more reliant on other countries shipping us goods and other transportation systems that are less efficient, such as road and rail. The U.S. maritime fleet today is 40,000 ships, which sounds like a lot, but more than half of those ships currently are used in the Mississippi, like barges and tugboats. 9 out of every 10 commercial vessels produced in the U.S. shipyards since 2010 have been barges or tugboats. So we're not producing giant ships that carry shipping containers like the ones that we get from China and Korea that travel across the world.
Mm-hmm.
So among ocean-going ships of at least 1,000 gross tons that transport cargo and meet the Jones Act requirements, they've gone from 193 to 99 since 2000. Yet we only have 99 ships that can actively transport large amounts of cargo between U.S. ports.
That's crazy. So are we using other countries' ships, or are we just relying on other countries' products?
So we don't allow other countries' ships because of the Jones Act.
Yeah.
We just don't ship a lot of stuff by sea. So currently, only 2% of products are shipped by waterway in the U.S. Compare this to Europe, which ships 40% of its goods through waterways. And this is when the U.S. has 25,000 miles of navigable waterways. We have the best country in the world for shipping. We have the Mississippi River, the Missouri River, the Arkansas River, the Hudson River. We have the Great Lakes. We have such an interconnected water system. Not shipping, but from state to state is ridiculous and inefficient and just makes it very complicated. And you have to think of the parts of the U.S. that aren't in the continuous U.S., like Puerto Rico and Alaska. So instead of buying goods from the U.S., it's usually cheaper for them to get goods from other countries because the ships have to meet the Jones Act if they're coming from the U.S. Whenever there's a hurricane or something bad happens to Puerto Rico, they have to waive the Jones Act to allow other ships to help because we can't handle saving the people of Puerto Rico without other ships, without relying on foreign countries because we don't have enough ships to meet their needs.
Oh, that's actually terrible for the people of Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Really bad bureaucracy.
Yeah, it definitely is getting in the way of much more efficient and effective ways of doing business and transporting goods. You know how the U.S. is one of the large producers of natural gas?
I did know that. It makes it harder for us to export that.
So the U.S. doesn't make liquid natural gas ships. So we can't ship liquid natural gas to ourselves. So you can't like ship it from New Orleans or Texas up to the East Coast, like New York or Virginia, because we don't make those ships, so they're not qualified in the Jones Act. So we have to export what we don't ship through pipelines and on roads.
That's kind of crazy, because like if we have such a large production of natural gas, liquefied natural gas, why aren't we taking advantage of that by producing these ships? It just seems so counterintuitive, and like we're letting this one bureaucratic rule get in the way of everything, right?
Yeah. This is another impact of the Jones Act, is we're not producing ships because we are so much more expensive to produce these ships. When you have such a protectionist policy in place, innovation and improving your economies of scale just doesn't happen. It leads to bloat of business. So ships in the U.S. cost $190 to $250 million to produce, whereas in other countries such as China, Japan, or Europe, producing those same ships cost only $30 million. So we're paying 5 times as much for the same ships.
Oh my gosh, that's a huge difference. I feel like if we just, you know, got rid of the Jones Act and let up on some of this bureaucracy, it would be so much cheaper for us to be shipping and producing goods.
The Jones Act is very large and encompassing, so it would be very difficult to fully get rid of it. Mm-hmm. But removing some British provisions, such as the requirement of ships to be made in the U.S., would really reduce the burden on U.S. shipyards and U.S. shipping companies and open foreign-made ships to transport goods. And we can still put in requirements that require certain amounts of U.S. crews and U.S. ownership. this policy was to ensure ships were being made in the U.S. It has not worked. So there are way more major shipyards in Japan, China, and Europe, which is defined as shipyards capable of producing ships longer than 150 meters. The U.S. only has 7 of those major shipyards, and 4 of those are exclusively military shipyards, whereas Europe has 60, and Japan and China have 1,000 and 2,000, respectively. So all this protectionism, and we still haven't been producing ships. To put an exclamation point on how uncompetitive U.S. ships are, only 4.6% of U.S.-built ships are exported. No one wants our ships. We're just too expensive. No one's interested. We're not selling a good product anymore.
That's crazy. So what does this have to do with the environment?
Shipping is the most CO2-efficient, most energy-efficient, and like largest bulk way of transporting goods. Rail produces 3-5 times as much pollution as shipping. And then you have trucking, which produces even more than that, which is, and shipping by trucking is expected to grow 44% by 2045, according to the Department of Transportation. So we're becoming really reliant on this inefficient way, this very fuel-intensive, polluting way of transporting goods. And it keeps all these giant trucks on the road, which I prefer not to be running into on the highway during rush hour.
Yeah, me too. I don't like the giant trucks.
And if we could just shift some of that transportation capabilities to waterways, it would reduce a lot of pollution, a lot of emissions, and would free up our highways. Shipping on land also does the most damage to our roadways. They are only a small portion of the amount of cars on the roadway, but they do the majority of the damage to the roadways and cause it to need a lot of maintenance. Yeah, just needs a lot of maintenance because of the trucking.
Huh. I mean, I guess that makes sense. And I also think trucking is probably one of the most dangerous ways of shipping goods as well, right?
I haven't looked up that, but anecdotally, yeah, it is terrifying having an 18-wheeler, like thousands of 18-wheelers driving around constantly when we could just shift that to one cargo ship going between ports and out of the way.
I've known people who died while driving trucks. I'm concerned for people as they are working in trucking. It's definitely not an easy job. It's definitely dangerous. If we got rid of the Jones Act and we started, you know, utilizing our waterways, or I should say, got rid of a few provisions in the Jones Act, you know, we could save a lot of carbon, but also think we could be saving a lot of lives, right?
Yeah, we could save a lot of lives, reduce the traffic congestion on major highways.
Mm-hmm.
It would be also more economically efficient. The World Economic Forum did a study, and if 500,000 containers were moved from highway and rail to shipping, it would save $200 million a year in expenses.
Really?
It doesn't sound like a much on like a global scale, but every little bit matters. That was just moving 500,000 containers. The Jones Act was fully repealed, U.S. shipping costs would go down by 50% and would add $135 billion to American economic output every year.
Oh my God.
And that's nothing to sneeze at.
No, it's definitely not. We're leaving like money on the table.
Yeah. We're choosing less economically efficient ways, less environmentally efficient ways of transporting goods, putting a heavier burden on our systems with very little benefit. If you look at projects going on in Europe and other countries around the world, they are trying to increase the amount of shipping they can do. They're trying to increase the connectivity of their rivers, building huge canals to increase how much they're shipping. In the U.S., we just seem to not understand this. We don't see the benefit of investing in our infrastructure and reducing the burden on our highways and railways by relying on what has been naturally given to us.
Thinking about how many jobs can we produce, how many, you know, how much safer it is, how much more carbon there is. I'm wondering, like, the Jones Act feels like this, like, antiquated, bureaucratic thing. And, you know, being a conservative, I'm really tired of those kinds of laws, you know? And I'm wondering if you can think of other laws that kind of do the same thing. And if there's a way that we can kind of, like, measure, like, how long a law should be applied. Because times change and things become less relevant and honestly begin to hurt the U.S. economy and the United States citizens themselves, too.
Yeah. this 100-year law is still sticking around and is doing damage to our economy and our environment. I think we should take a look at it. And I'm sure there are plenty of other rules and regulations that we can take a look at that have been around for decades or centuries and just haven't been repealed and not updated. And it's causing inefficiencies in our system.
I'm also thinking about like things that happen in government that are very well-intentioned, but in practice, they don't work and they're not practical, if that makes sense. This is one of those things where, you know, it did benefit the U.S. for a certain period of time, but now it's really hurting us. So Zach, tell me more about the Jones Act and how it affects other aspects of the economy. I mean, we've already heard quite a bit about transportation and we're leaving money on the table, but what else does it do in terms of how it affects the economy? I'm curious.
So the biggest victims are those not in the U.S., that are those not in the contiguous U.S., like Alaska, Hawaii, Guam, that pay a high premium to get products shipped to them because of the higher cost that U.S. Jones Act qualified ships cost. But it's also hindering the movement of natural gas, diesel between the Gulf Coast and the East and West Coast, which could benefit from an ease of movement of fossil fuels. On to renewables is reducing the production of renewables, because if you look at offshore wind farms, they need very specialized vehicles to place those windmills in the ocean and to set their bases. And we don't make those vessels in the U.S. When we want an offshore wind farm, we need foreign vessels to assist us in putting those windmills into the ocean. But the Jones Act restricts them from traveling between two U.S. ports. We're basically choking ourselves off out of taking any action because of this law. It just stops us from being able to do anything because we just don't make the ships.
That's actually so sad. It's really important that we are able to offer a diverse energy portfolio. And, you know, this act is just making it like impossible for us to make a clean energy transition, especially in states that want to be making that clean energy transition. It just seems like it would be so good for the environment, not only in the way that shipping is the best method for transporting goods in terms of the environment, but also like it would allow us to have offshore wind projects. Offshore wind projects have the highest potential for its energy output. We're leaving energy security on the table as well, aren't we?
Yeah. This law just makes everything more complicated for the U.S.
Yeah.
When we're not producing our own ships, which are just so economically unfeasible at this point, that we won't.
Okay, Zach, so tell me, like, what are like the three things you want our listeners to remember about the Jones Act?
The Jones Act was an old law instituted for World War I reasons and is not helpful in today's U.S. It is harming the environment by pushing goods to be shipped by large trucks instead of on waterways, like through container ships. And it is hindering our transition to renewable energy by preventing vessels that can assist with that transition from docking at U.S. ports.
Those are some really good things to remember about the Jones Act. And what can our listeners do? How should we approach this problem?
This is definitely a topic that needs to be brought up with members of Congress and brought to their attention, because this is not a topic that gets traction anywhere or is popular. This is very niche and unknown, but it's a major impact on our daily lives. So talking to your member of Congress, saying that this is something that you are aware of, maybe they'll read up and find out what the Jones Act is and form an opinion on it. We'll see what it is.
You know, I didn't even know about the Jones Act before we started talking about it today. And I think that like, as we talk about these government inefficiencies, I hope that we'll continue to look at the kind of antiquated laws there are and start making, you know, better decisions about, you know, what we're letting guide our economy, whether or not we're aware of it, you know?
Yeah. Things are worth taking a second look at. What is most efficient 100 years ago may not be most efficient now.
Yeah, definitely not. So let's move into our closing. What are the action steps for our listeners today?
Contact your member of Congress or your senator and tell them you thought about the Jones Act. Do your own research, tell them your opinions and see what they think and see if they have any idea of any legislation or ways to improve the Jones Act or its efficiency. And I would also say, read the Jones Act, A Burden America Can No Longer Bear, from the Cato Institute, which is a very detailed, long piece that goes through the Jones Act and the impact it's having on the U.S. economy.
I am very familiar with the Cato Institute and do know a lot of their work is very impactful. So that is a very good reading. Also, for you, our listener, another thing you can do is please email us with your thoughts on the Jones Act and on this episode. Our email is info@greenteapartyradio.com. And thank you so much for listening to Green Tea Party Radio, and a very special thank you to all of our patrons. We could not do this without you.
Yeah, and if you're interested in getting early access to episodes as well as Green Tea Party Radio merch, check us out at greenteapartyradio.com. If you have feedback, tell us what's on your mind and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok.
And just so you know, this is our passion project. We don't have any organizational sponsor. We're building a movement because we want the world to know that conservatives have important things to say about climate change.
And if you want to hear our show on your college radio station, email us at info@greenteapartyradio.com and give us the details about your campus and your radio station. The email again is info@greenteapartyradio.com.
Thank you, Zach.
Thank you, Anna. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Drew Ierley. I am the Conservative Outreach Director for Citizens Climate Lobby. My path to being a conservative, concerned about climate action, was definitely a long one. Growing up, it was a very rural area. You had to be into the outdoors or you were going to be bored out of your mind. So I grew up doing a lot of hunting, fishing. I was the second person on my mom's side to graduate high school. I graduated June 6th, 05 at like 7:30 at night, and by 8 o'clock the next morning, I was on my way to basic training on my 17th birthday. I had deployments to Iraq, Afghanistan, rotations through Cuba. It was during this time that I really became concerned with energy infrastructure, but I wasn't ready to take action yet. It took the birth of a 10-pound baby girl with cheeks so big she couldn't open her eyes to really get me to open mine. My life just went from the next 50 years to the next 75. What if she's the veteran that follows in my footsteps and she's in the VA suffering from exposure? You know, what if she's on a fossil fuel route and, you know, subject to an IED? How will I be able to look at her in the eye and say, I knew that this could be an issue that you would have to face and I chose to do nothing about it? It's why we fight wars. You know, we fight them now so our kids don't have to. I am fighting climate change now so my daughters don't have to. A lot of people, you know, they say conservatives don't care about climate change, and you know, it's not true at all. We just want sensible policies that don't destroy the economy in trying to find a solution. We have that here at Citizens Climate Lobby. There are a lot of leadership opportunities for conservatives, especially in red states and districts with Republican congressional offices. Conservatives can also join CCL's Conservative Caucus. It's a national group of Republicans and other right-of-center individuals where conservatives can get together and regularly meet online and have strictly conservative-based conversations. Sharing our personal story is how we make a difference.
Conservative and concerned about climate change? You're not alone. My name is Chelsea Henderson, and I host RepublicEN.org's EcoRight Speaks, bringing you weekly guest interviews and stories. John Kasich, Christine Todd Whitman, Congresswoman Nancy Mace, meteorologist Marshall Shepard. Each week, we have a conversation with an EcoRight leader bringing you information, opinions, personal stories, and much, much more. Download, listen, subscribe, and join us each week on the EcoRight Speaks.